Hello, it's Friday, the 22nd of October. I'm Richard Spur, sitting in for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Still to come, why many people living with unsafe cladding in their homes aren't satisfied with the Chancellor's new offer of financial help. How a bill passing through Parliament to assist terminally ill patients to die is still fraught with controversy. And will the new reboot of the sci-fi film Dune sink or swim? But first, as it's revealed that the Queen did spend a night in a London hospital, what do we know about the state of her health and her ability to carry out public duties in the future? The Queen was admitted to hospital for tests on Wednesday, just hours after cancelling her visits to Northern Ireland. Buckingham Palace also confirmed last night that the 95-year-old monarch was kept overnight for practical reasons, but she is understood to have returned to light duties. Well, I'm joined now by Ingrid Seward, royal biographer and editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine. Ingrid, what more do we know now?
Well, we don't know a great deal more, apart from the fact that the palace are saying that the reason that they kept discreet about this was really for the sake of the Queen, who obviously didn't want to have the hospital surrounded with media, because she knows only too well that any alert about her, or in the past as it was about Prince Philip, I mean, and the whole world are scrambling, you know, thinking that she's going to pop off any moment. And it would have been pretty unpleasant for her to have to run the gauntlet of photographers, albeit that you come out of a side entrance there. I think it's actually called the morgue entrance, which is where Prince Philip it is, because I think that's where the coffins come out. So, but she could have come out of a side entrance, but I think really they were protecting her, but it's backfired because people think, well, if they lie about that, what else have they lied about?
I suppose so. And there was an attempt, wasn't there, to dissemble, because a very small royal standard, I noticed, was still flying above Windsor when the Queen wasn't there. She was in central London in hospital. And they had to admit in the end that, yes, she had in fact gone.
Though there was it her personal standard or just a Union Jack?
It was a royal standard.
It was. So it would be. Well, that's most unusual. That's most unusual, because normally when she leaves, the standard is taken down, and when she arrives, the standard goes up. That's sort of been procedure for hundreds of years, so that is very unusual. So it did not a bit of subterfuge there, I think, don't you?
There may well be. Although she is, as you say, as anyone is, entitled to her privacy, how significant do you think this whole episode is? I mean, will we see the Queen actually getting to COP and being able to perform her duties there, which I think probably is very important to her and to the public?
Oh, I'm sure we will. I'm absolutely sure we will, because she's pretty stoic. And obviously, having had this period of rest, which is pretty unusual for her, she'll be even more determined not to let everybody down. That's what she really dislikes, is letting people down. And unless she's seriously ill, I would think she would very definitely be there. And I suppose we rather feel that because the palace played down the Queen's involvement with the hospital, I think people perhaps become more concerned, you know, because they weren't sort of upfront and straight about it. But I think it's a bit of a no-win situation.
Is there any hint, maybe on the inside track or from people who you know, as to what this condition might be, what these tests were about?
Absolutely none. I mean, it could be. I mean, I don't think we would know anyone of 95 who didn't have some medical problems. It would be very, very unusual, wouldn't it? I mean, the Queen had an operation on her knee quite a long time ago now, and I think she hurt her knee riding. And but she, you know, however sharp her mind is, her body is the body of a 95-year-old woman. So there's got to be, you know, probably quite a few little tweaks and twists and things that are going wrong with it.
And just finally, is this perhaps a subtle cue for younger members of the royal family to take over more of the commitments that the Queen hitherto would have performed?
I think probably it is. I mean, the younger members of the royal family have been doing a lot more recently, and so have the older members. I mean, Princess Anne never ever stops, and nor does Prince Charles. So I think perhaps things like investitures, when she has to stand for a long time, I mean, maybe she'll you know, do less of those, or smaller ones. I think it'll be very subtle, that it's basically up to her and what, you know, and she will follow the advice of her doctors, which she has done, obviously, these last few days. But it is really up to her and her medical advisors what she can and cannot do.
Well, we wish her all the very best. And that was Ingrid Seward, Royal Biographer and Editor-in-Chief of Majesty Magazine. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, promised a new tax on developers to recoup around £2 billion of the cost of removing cladding from high-rise buildings. The tax will be on profits above £25 million and will come into force from next year. Ministers have pledged £5.1 billion to help end the safety crisis in the wake of the Grenfell Tower fire in West London, which killed 72 people in June 2017. Well, I'm joined now by Giles Grover, campaigner with End Our Cladding Scandal, who lives in a building with unsafe cladding. Giles, how do you receive this news?
It's nothing we haven't heard before, really. It's one of those old government rehashing of old announcements saying they're trying to hold the construction industry to account when, as far as we're concerned, in the face of what is estimated as between a £15 and £50 billion problem, it's a pitiful amount, really, and they need to do a lot more to really hold those developers to account who've caused the issues that we're facing right now.
Is there nothing good in this news for people who, like you, live with unsafe cladding?
Nothing that we haven't heard before. It's positive that there's some money being raised, but one of the things the government is keeping hidden or not making as public, as we all know, is that that £2 billion is actually going to pay down the £5 billion funding that was announced in February. So as far as we're concerned, there needs to be more funding, double, triple that amount, and it needs to go on top of the £5 billion. Then you start making the step towards solving this crisis for once and for all.
I suppose the counter-argument would be that the government is in great debt. There are huge financial burdens upon it, given the pandemic. And maybe, although this obviously is essential, it isn't quite up there at the sort of financial level that you might expect. I mean, would you understand that argument?
I can understand the argument. And I know that the way government operates are now in this way of saying it's leaseholders versus taxpayers almost, which is kind of a frustrating way they're tackling this whole crisis. I understand there is a lot of money. We appreciate that. It has taken us 2 years to even get this far. And one of the things we always say is look at all the money that actually has gone to the construction industry over the years, whether it's through Help to Buy with not necessarily positive consequences for actually helping people and more about inflating house prices. The Exchequer loses billions of pounds to the zero rating of construction on VAT, the new buildings, the Chancellor's stamp duty, land tax relief, is going to cost about £7 billion. So the problem is that the government has spent 2 years after the tragedy at Grenfell saying building owners and developers should do the right thing. It's now up to the government to do the right thing. And what we also say is that there are many solutions around there in terms of actually getting the money back from industry, of actually holding those developers to account. But one thing is, for 30 to 40 years, the regulations have been weak. They've been inadequate. There was a fire in 2009. It was quite clear after that that the whole regulations need to be completely reviewed because they were so weak and gameable and allowed a lot of bad practice. It's a state and industry failure. It's a complete abdication of responsibility that the innocent homeowner who's just trying to take that step on the property ladder is going to be forced to pay to fix this crisis. Billions of pounds. Some people with costs running into hundreds of thousands of pounds. It's just a disgrace.
Giles, what's been your personal experience of the cladding crisis in your own context?
So my experience, we were first told that we might have ACM cladding, which is the same cladding as was on Grenfell Tower. That was in July 2017. We've actually still got that cladding on our building. Scaffolding's gone up. Work's now starting. However, we've been told it's going to cost a total of around £40,000 per individual to make their home safe. The government's so far only allocating us half of that, so we've still got to find another £20,000. That's one side of it in terms of the financial aspect. One thing that often gets forgotten about is the mental health aspect. We are literally trapped. We're in our flats. During the pandemic, it was just so much worse where you can't leave your flat. You don't feel safe inside. You don't feel safe outside. So until the government gets a grip of this crisis, until they actually say, right, for all buildings, we need a proper, long-lasting solution. They're still focused on media management. We need Michael Gove to step in and say, right, let's just look afresh, start again, and actually help the people who are the innocent parties in this crisis.
And have you had any indication of when your cladding is going to be fixed?
Well, the project actually started in April. It's already been delayed because of design issues, because they've uncovered other things. We've been told that it should initially finish around February next year. Now we're told it's delayed for some more months. The scaffolding's getting closer to my balcony, but the ACM is still on there. Ultimately, even once that work's done, the other issues, we still don't know how we're going to fund them. We've been paying towards a fire safety fund. I've paid about £6,000-7,000 towards that, but not everyone in our building is going to be able to afford that. So there's so many holes in the government's approach to it as it stands, and we just don't really see an end until they actually just sit down and say, let's get a handle on the true scale of the crisis, then let's ensure that we've got funding for the buildings that actually need it, whatever the height they are, whatever the defect is.
Well, I wish you all the best, and many thanks for taking the time. That was Giles Grover, campaigner with Endire Cladding, who himself lives in a building with unsafe cladding. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus. Today, the House of Lords will give Baroness Meacher's assisted dying bill its second reading, allowing the prescription of a lethal cocktail of drugs to seriously ill people. The bill is likely to pass through the Lords, but face political contest in the Commons, as those against the bill argue it is unsafe and a painful way to die. Well, I'm joined now by Daily Mail writer David Rose. David, just talk a little bit more about what this bill involves.
Well, the bill is very closely modelled on the laws that exist in a number of American states, and in some cases have done for over 20 years, so that if two doctors certify that a person has 6 months or less to live, that they're of sound mind, of proper mental capacity, and are making the decision of their own free will, they will certify that that person may seek help in dying. And then one of those doctors will actually prescribe the lethal drugs and will be present when the drugs are administered. But the patient will have to take them themselves. This is not euthanasia, where a doctor gives a lethal injection of perhaps morphine or heroin or something, which does in fact again happen in one or two countries such as Canada. This is assisted dying, so the patient has to be the person who either drinks the cocktail, or if they're in a state of paralysis where they can't actually do that, they would be able to operate some sort of pump that might give them an intravenous injection that would kill them.
It's such a difficult and vexed area, and really rather difficult one to talk about. None of us likes to contemplate our own mortality. What about these issues of it being a painful way to die? Is there any real independent proof about that?
Well, the problem is that there's no proper data, because what we're talking about here is using drugs which are designed and tested to improve patients' lives, either to reduce the risk of dying or to alleviate the effects of certain illnesses. We're talking about using the side effects of those drugs used in an overdose to kill them. Now, obviously, those drugs are not used for that purpose normally. There are no clinical trials which indicate what the appropriate doses should be. And in the case of the American states, where this has been happening on a fairly large scale, there's not even a settled cocktail. There are a number of different mixtures that are being used. It used to be the case that the usual main component was a large overdose of barbiturates, but it's become very difficult to obtain those drugs in America because of drug abuse. At the moment, the same is true in the UK. Now, some say that the British pharmaceutical industry could ramp up production of barbiturates for this purpose, but then these, again, are drugs that are not designed to do this, and, of course, we're still going to be talking about relatively small numbers, so it's not at all clear that you could get those supplies. So if you're not using barbiturates, you're using combinations of other medications, and we don't really know what the safe doses are, what the lethal doses are, the guaranteed lethal doses are, and we don't know what the patient will experience when they're going through them, because once they've lost consciousness, they're not telling you. Now, two of the most worrying things that have been happening in America, and that there's well-documented evidence of this, in fact, there are annual reports in the states where this is used, which give details. The two things that are happening are, one, in some cases, patients are actually waking up after taking what they thought was the dose of drugs that would kill them. The other thing is that they're taking a very long time to die. And sometimes, while that happens, they're suffering really some considerable distress. Now, my article in the paper today looks at the case of a man in Colorado who took 8.25 hours to die. But when he was taking the cocktail of drugs, he was choking and coughing. And so what his wife had hoped would be a sort of very gentle, calming experience, which would, you know, he would drink his lethal drugs, and then they would sort of say goodbye, they'd have a last embrace, and he would slip gently into that good night. Instead, it was very traumatic, and he did eventually lose consciousness, but he was gasping. He seemed to be in distress, not fully unconscious, and she became very concerned that he could hear what was happening. And then 8.25 hours after taking these drugs, he sat up in bed and retched, and then finally did stop breathing. So this was not this sort of, well, as Baroness Tanny Gray Thompson puts it, the Hollywood death that some supporters of assisted dying have envisaged.
What you've just described is quite horrific. In light of these anomalies, I mean, is there any chance of this legislation getting through in the UK?
Well, not at the moment. So it will pass its second reading because the convention in the House of Lords is that private members' bills are unopposed. Then it will go into the committee stage where it may face amendments. Now, it is possible that it will pass the House of Lords. Then it will go to the Commons. I suppose it is theoretically possible that it could even pass the Commons. But I think there are many, many issues that will crop up. Now, there is this new all-party parliamentary group on dying well, which includes Tanny Gray Thompson, it includes Baroness Elora Finlay, who is herself a palliative care consultant, and a number of MPs. And they're planning to hold a proper inquiry in which evidence on the effects of these drugs, what patients experience, what families experience, the length of time it takes to kill people, and also whether this is going to have a negative impact on other services, will all be discussed. Now, of course, there are ultimate ethical issues, which the three religious leaders have raised in a joint letter earlier this week, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Roman Catholic Cardinal, and the Chief Rabbi. But besides those sort of overarching ethical issues, there are slightly more practical issues about healthcare. If we make assisted dying the norm for terminal patients, will that lead to a deterioration in the quality of palliative care? Now, a lot of palliative care doctors, and it's noticeable, by the way, that most palliative care doctors do not support this measure. They say you can die well, but you can die well at home or in a hospice given the right palliative care. You don't need to be in pain. You don't need to be in distress. Much better to let nature take its course. The second point is even more disturbing. Now, I personally know of two people quite close to me who were given prognoses that they would live for 6 months or less. Now, one of them, extraordinarily, is still alive 24 years later. He had a fast-growing pancreatic tumor, and for reasons that nobody can explain, he survived. And in that time, he's not simply had a good quality of life. He's founded a thriving business. He's traveled. He's got married. He's had a full life, and he's still alive. In fact, he survived an aneurysm last year. Somebody else close to me actually did investigate the possibility of going to Dignitas in Switzerland, where, of course, patients can already go if they are UK citizens, and then suffering from an unpleasant form of cancer, got a new treatment, and 2 years later, she's still alive, and she's just come back from a very nice holiday. So, you know, when we say, oh, you've got 6 months to live, it's not so cut and dried. Giving terminal prognoses, as palliative care doctors have been telling me this week, is a very inexact science. And I do think there is a great risk that people might, you know, in that tremendous emotional turmoil that's bound to follow when you get such a diagnosis, say, okay, I'm going to end it all. But then perhaps if they're given the care they need to alleviate the symptoms, and then care that may actually prolong their lives by quite a long time, and not just prolong their lives, but prolong high quality life. Well, you know, I think these are the issues that really need to be gone into much more carefully, and this new all-party parliamentary group intends to do just that.
Well, David, that was both sobering but also actually fascinating. So many thanks for taking the time today. That was Daily Mail writer David Rose. Denis Villeneuve's much-anticipated Dune reboot is out in cinemas today, and it takes on a book described as a science fiction version of The Lord of the Rings. Based on Frank Herbert's best-selling 1965 novel, a film version was made by David Lynch in 1984, and another was abandoned. So, has Denis Villeneuve, director of Blade Runner 2049, got it right this time? Well, I'm joined by Daily Mail film critic Brian Viner. Brian, you know, sci-fi fans have been waiting some time for this reboot. What's the delay been about?
Well, a certain pandemic hasn't helped. And, you know, it's just also a hugely expensive film. And these things, you know, they take a while. So he announced it, I think, about 5 years ago. But, you know, people have been waiting for the remake of Dune for years now, and you know, everybody thought it was unfilmable. The 1984 version by David Lynch didn't do much to contradict that idea. So you know, but finally we have it, and it's very, very good.
Just talk for those who have no idea about Dune. Just sort of what the texture and the narrative and the style of this film is.
Well, it's I mean, the original 1965 novel, which you just referred to by Frank Herbert, is a great big doorstopper. And it creates, a bit like The Lord of the Rings and a bit like Star Wars, it creates a whole new world set about 8,000 years into the future. I think it's the year 10,191, if you can get your head around that. And so it's just an alternative universe, but a kind of a parallel universe, really, to the one in which we live, because they have on this... Dune refers to this planet, this very kind of arid desert planet called Arrakis, and the but underneath the sand, or we don't quite know where it's coming from, but anyway, this planet produces something called spice, and spice is the sort of is the answer to everything, and it makes the people who produce it incredibly rich. And I don't think you have to be, you know, too brilliant to see it as a euphemism for oil. Now, whether that's what Frank Herbert had in mind all those years ago, I don't know, but that's certainly what it looks like to me now. So that's that planet, and then there's another planet which is inhabited, which is a much more kind of salubrious place, and the ruling body, the House of Atreides, is the sort of royal family on that planet, and that's called Caladan. And the House of Atreides are told that they have to go and take over the production of spice on Arrakis. So it's all about them, a bit like the Americans kind of going into Afghanistan. It's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like that, really. So you have to get your head around this whole new world. And, you know, Denis Villeneuve does it very well.
You clearly know a great deal about it, and you would have seen this new version. And how do you rate it personally? And also, how does it compare to the 1984 version?
Well, I think it's a good deal better than the 1984 version, which I thought was a mess. It's sort of become a bit of a cult classic in the years since. But, you know, if you go back and look at it now, the thing is that, of course, in the, you know, however many, the 30-odd years since then, technology has advanced hugely in terms of filmmaking. So the special effects now are very much better than they were then. And it's just, I mean, David Lynch is a pretty eccentric filmmaker, and Denis Villeneuve, it's Denis, by the way, in the French way rather than Denis, he's French-Canadian, actually, but he, you know, he's got form in sci-fi. He made a very good film called Arrival, and then he made, as you referred to, he made Blade Runner 2049, and they were terrific, both of them, and he just, you know, he handles this very well. It is a huge story with lots of characters. But I should say that this only tells half the story. So assuming that this is goes on and, you know, becomes a big box office hit, then I think I know that we will see the second episode, if you like, the sequel, in a few years.
Brilliant. Well, many thanks for bringing us up to date. That was Daily Mail film critic Brian Viner. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. He'll be back with you on Monday. Have a great evening. Good night.